following is an excerpt from a telephone interview with Robert Rabin. Robert Rabin is a premier keynote speaker, leadership advisor, and self-awareness teacher. He's the author of numerous books and hundreds of articles. He is also the author and creator of Real-Time Speaking, You Are the Message. He presents a variety of talks, workshops, and programs, emphasizing the power of authentic self-expression. Robert's Real-Time Speaking audiobook is available at wetwaremedia.com. That's WETWAREMEDIA.com. Robert currently lives in Australia and will be on tour in the United States in the spring of 2010. If you'd like more information about his You Are the Message tour, please visit robertrabinusa.com.
If we're going to talk for a minute about that article I wrote, then yes, I think one of the ways that we misuse teachers is to create an idea of who they are and who we want them to be, while at the same time closing our eyes to who they actually are outside the teaching environment, because we don't want to know who they really are, because we're going to find that they're too much like us. And then, you know, in so doing, we elevate them into an imaginary role. We think that they have all kinds of elevated, wholly encased in white behaviors that none of us manifest. You know, like at the end of the day, they just get mystically transferred to a pod or something where they just plug into the cosmic breathing. And then we get, you know, then we go to war with who we are, with our impulses, with our desires, with our daily living. We think that there's something wrong with it, and then we just keep aspiring to achieve or attain some imagined idealized state that we never can. Then we start suppressing who we are or denying who we are because we think it's not good enough. And then we keep trying to imitate something that we think our teachers are like, but that's totally imaginary. And so we get trapped in this made-up world where there's no actual living. There's no actual authenticity. There's no actual passion or engagement with life. And it's a tragedy. I did that for years. One of the things that I talk about in the real-time speaking workshops is a distinction between three words. One is natural, one is familiar, one is habitual. Three words. Because people create a sense of familiarity. I'm familiar with self-suppression. I'm familiar with being afraid of authentic self-expression. I'm familiar with being numb, going to a workplace that in which I shut down. I'm familiar with that. So we mistake the familiar with the natural, because if our experience is so familiar and so customary, we start thinking, well, that's just how it is. But the familiar is really created through habit. It's habitual. It doesn't mean it's natural. And while I agree with you that we are used to, we are familiar with a lot of ways of being, I don't agree that it's natural, because I think the natural state is actually exuberant, wild, free self-expression, to be creative, to be original. And how do I know that? Because I've lived and worked all over the world. In every culture and in every country that I've been to, when I observe the nature of children, I see the same thing. I see that they are programmed, they are built to be expressive and creative. Everywhere you go, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's an indigenous culture, a third world culture, whether it's a state-of-the-art Western Zurich, Switzerland culture. What do children the world over, from the Tibetan plateaus to the Amazonian rain jungles, what do children the world over start doing just shortly after they can start walking? They skip and they hop. Little kids can't walk. They can only skip and hop, because they have too much exuberance. They have too much enthusiasm. They have too much life force. They skip and they hop. But the first thing to note is what is natural, because you know we've got to be able to count on something, some pre-existing truth. The pre-existing truth is what I come to just by observation, which is it is not to be numb and self-suppressed and fearful. In my mind, it's important to recognize through observation that human beings the world over are, without exception, born to be creative and expressive, and they skip and they hop and they dance and they sing and they play and they color. It's natural. Then what happens? I don't think we lose the energy. I think what happens is through a series of experiences and self-limiting decisions, we begin to close ourselves off to that same life force, that same energy, which is always present, because if it wasn't, we'd fall over dead. But what happens is we start developing habits. And how do you start a habit? A habit is originally what? Isn't it a choice? Doesn't a habit always begin as a choice, as a decision in a moment? And then how does it become habitual? Because we keep making the same choice, we keep making the same decision over and over until we forget that the thing was created in a moment as a function of a decision and as a function of a choice, until we start labeling it, well, this is just how it is, this is natural, but we really mistake it for something that's familiar. And that's an important distinction, because what's happening is what is familiar to us, in most cases, as adults, having gone through a series of self-limiting decisions and choices, which become embedded as a self-image and a belief system, we mistake the habitual for the natural. So we go, well, that's just familiar. Of course you go to work and you just do the best you can. Of course you live in a relationship in which you only tell half the truth. Of course you go through life being, you know, somewhat sad and alienated. Of course you go through life being confused and lost. Of course we're going to be inept. That's just how it is. Well, that's not how it is. That's how we've brought it into existence. And all along the way, we're working against nature. We're working against the skipping and the hopping. I had a meeting last night, a three-hour meeting with the managing director of a company that has about 450 people in it. And I'm starting to work with him, his leadership team, and the whole company to create a culture of magic in which people will bring forth their innate capacities as distinct from the competencies that most workplaces focus on, thinking, okay, you just got to learn how to do this, this, and this, all the while forgetting the inner capacity, the capacity for spontaneity, for intuition, for courage, for initiative, for responsibility, for coloring outside the boxes. And so that's what we're trying to bring forth. We're trying to bring forth what is natural. Emotion, feeling, connection, all of those things. But look at most workplaces. Most workplaces ask you to leave everything that makes you human outside the door because it can't be controlled. It's too wild and unpredictable. And, you know, often will have its own trajectory. If we were really committed to, if we were really fiercely determined to be natural, to be our natural self, to bring forth our own unique form of expression and creativity, we would never go to work in those places. But we do, every day. Why do we do that? Because there's something in us that's willing to betray our own freedom, our own self-expression, our own dancing and singing. And, you know, we'll say, well, I'll do that at night, I'll do that on the weekend, but I won't do it here. But we can't blame a workplace, we can't blame a company, we really can't blame anyone for the choices we make. So it has a lot to do with what our response is to that beautiful couple of lines from the end of a Mary Oliver poem. In Mary Oliver, the American poet, just an exquisite, beautiful writer. And at the end of one of her poems, she says, "Tell me, what is it you intend to do with your one wild and precious life?" What a beautiful question that is. What do you, no attitude. She's not accusing you or telling you what to do. She's just saying, what do you intend to do with your one wild and precious life? And that, to me, is a really important, maybe the most important question we can seriously ask ourselves. Because the answer to that determines whether or not we're going to live in a small little space to be safe, or whether we're going to explore the bigness and the possibilities of living. One of the things I brought up in the meeting last night, because this fellow was telling me certain things that he believed to be true, and I said, well, that's just your story about what you think is true. He goes, no, it's true. And I said, well, this is an interesting point that we have to really examine. Because what I was teling him is that I happen to side with what I believe the gypsies do, which is the gypsies create reality and history based on who can tell the most vivid and compelling story. It's a little bit like a game show. All right, what happened? Contestant number one, tell your story. Contestant number two, tell your story. Contestant number three, tell your story. And then they go, okay, audience, which was the most vivid, believable, exciting, compelling story? And that's what happened. And so I asked this fellow, who had been married for 25 years, he's not married at the moment, and I said, did you ever have any arguments with your wife along the years? And he said, of course I did. And I said, well, what was usually the basis of it? And he said, well, we just disagreed on things. And I said, you mean you saw things differently? He said, yeah. And I said, well, then that proves my point. Because if there's an actual there out there, then we would all see the same thing because we all have the same eyes. We all have the same biology. If there's a fact, then it's a fact. Gravity comes close to a fact. If you and I, Lisa, or anyone else, jumps out of an airplane, what could we say? Statistically, wouldn't you agree that pretty close to 100% of the time we're going to fall downward toward the earth? There's a few things out there that in our human experience we can agree on are there. We've got gravity. We've got, what else? Death. Although, of course, we're really beginning to wonder at that. But there's a few things like that. But in terms of perception, in terms of what happened, in terms of trying to sort out the distinction we need to make between what you think is so and what's actually so, it's really important. Isn't it your experience that as you get older, you keep revising your personal history and you tell different stories about what happened in the past? We all do. I have two brothers and two sisters that I stay in touch with. I'm down here in Australia, they're in the States, and especially my two sisters. We're quite close. They're bright ladies. And yet, when we sometimes get together and talk about our childhoods, which allegedly were under the same roof with the same parents at the same time, you begin to think, what family did you grow up in? Gina and I have this kind of running joke because she remembers a German shepherd that we were supposed to have had for a number of years named Bruno. And I have absolutely no recollection. Okay, now I'm getting older, admittedly, and perhaps my mental faculties are beginning to fail. But I don't know. I'd like to think that I haven't turned the corner that suddenly, and I could still remember a dog we had for 10 years, and I don't. So I'm not going to make her wrong. I'm just going to make peace with, well, we've got different stories about what happened. And in my sister Gina's childhood, there was a Bruno, a dog, German Shepherd. Thankfully, she still includes me in her history. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to have many conversations. She goes, who is this? It's your brother, Robert. I don't have a brother, Robert. It's really important that we start looking at the nature of what's out there. What is out there? Is there a there? In some cases, I think we can say yes, gravity. But in most cases, I think we go, well, no. What was that movie that came out many years ago, a Japanese movie? I think it was called Rashomon, which was the story of a crime that was told through the eyes of the four different witnesses. The storyline is, well, we each saw the same thing. But you get them in the witness box and you ask them, and it turns out, well, in fact, there were four different crimes. So when we start postulating things as so, as this is what's so, this is factual, is that true, or is that simply what we're doing to create a kind of self-suppression on a bigger reality, a bigger possibility? I think one of the ways in which we do it, we do that to ourselves, is in spirituality and personal growth, because we've already broken off from the naturalness of our creative and expressive potential. So in a sense, we've become lost and confused by making a series of self-limiting decisions that alienate us. It's kind of like we banish ourselves from our own home, and then we keep trying to find our way back home. And then we project that being lost and confused out into the world, and someone comes along and says this, that, or the other thing, and we go, okay, they know. But of course, they can't know, because there's nothing anyone can tell you about finding your own natural self again, because you're the one who's turned away from it to begin with. I don't know that I know all of why it happens, but I've looked at it. I do think it's important to kind of look at what is the dynamic. How do we get lost and confused? One of the ways is we have negative experiences when we're young associated with what I call authentic self-expression. I'll give you an example. Only yesterday, I was being interviewed by a radio host for her show. And we were talking, it was talking about real-time speaking, and we were looking at confidence and authenticity in speaking and why we don't do that, and why we sometimes collapse in the presence of certain people and start doubting what we want to say. And I was explaining that a lot of times when we're all young and we express ourselves, we will be perhaps criticized or rejected or condemned or humiliated or embarrassed publicly for that. You know, it happens in schools. It happens in a lot of different ways and places for everyone I've ever met. We're young. We're maybe 3, 4, 5, or 6. And we don't have sufficient shakti. We don't have sufficient personal power to produce a different outcome in the face of those experiences. So what we do is we pull back from that creative or expressive place, and we make what I call an emotional decision. We make an instantaneous decision to stay small, to be safe. So it really is an issue of shakti, the Sanskrit word meaning creative power. And so what happens is we make those decisions instantaneously. They're not a rational decision-making process. They're an emotional decision that we make instantly in the moment to protect ourselves. How do we end up living estranged from our natural expressive self is through a series of self-protective decisions we make that involve it's not safe or okay to be expressive and creative. And then those decisions become embedded as part of who we are and what reality is. And then we go and look to others to help restore us to our wholeness. But we can't, because it's not about content. It's about power. It's never about here's the nature of reality, here's the nature of who you are, here's what to do. It has to do with a re-experiencing or reconnection of who we are to our energy source, to our shakti, to our power, to our creative and expressive power to be alive. And it's really a matter of owning and claiming that, which then frees us to revise and rewrite our history, but at the same time levels the playing field. And then we realize no one has any special knowledge. Everyone is simply living their own original life, expressing their story, and then we begin to appreciate storytelling for what it is, which is, this is what I think is out there, what do you think is out there? And then you tell that story, and you end up hanging out with people whose stories you like.
Thank you for listening to this telephone interview with Robert Rabin. Robert currently lives in Australia and will be on tour in the United States in the spring of 2010. If you'd like more information about his You Are the Message tour, please visit robertrabinusa.com.
I opened a recent talk at the Rainbow Serpent Festival, a big alternative music lifestyle festival here in Melbourne. I opened the talk with telling the folks there that in the 40 years that I've been involved intensely and directly with personal growth and meditation and self-inquiry, that I've learned five things. Three of them I learned in the 11 years that I spent studying meditation in an ashram. And then the other two I learned when I left the ashram and began to work as a leadership consultant in corporate America. I talked about these five principles to this group of people because after that I simply said, what questions do you have about anything? And I'll address it. The five things that I'm really good at aren't content-based. In other words, they don't have any particular content. They're all context. In other words, I don't have a particular point of view. I don't have a particular set of beliefs. I don't have a particular formula for anything. But these five principles, which I'll talk about in just a second, are what I've been looking back on my career of some 30 years, which includes leadership, coaching, organizational consulting, workshops, teaching, lecturing, writing, spiritual activism with the Radical Sages Project, now real-time speaking here in Australia. Whatever I've done, I've created from these five principles. And every impact that I've had with individuals, teams, organizations, communities, whatever I've done to facilitate people coming to a greater sense of clarity and fulfillment and purpose and energy has come from these five principles. And they are, one, be present. Being present to me means especially finding a way of engaging one's self and the world around us without the interference of the thought stream. In other words, thoughts, thinking, beliefs are by their very nature representational. Life itself is not representational. Life is direct and immediate and real. It's not conceptual and abstract. But most people live their entire lives in the representation of it by living in thoughts, beliefs, ideas, concepts. So the first principle is be present. I saw a cooking book the other day, and there were these beautiful pictures of food with each recipe for these. And it struck me that really being present is the difference between licking the page and eating the actual meal. If you see a picture of barbecued prawns and it looks fantastic, the picture is a representation of it. If you lick the paper, it's not going to taste very good. You got to go out onto the barbecue, put the prawns, cook them, then eat them. That's what I mean about being present in a non-representational way. Then the other thing is, next principle, pay attention. Don't drift away. Pay attention in two specific ways. Focus and awareness. In martial arts, they'll teach you to have a 1 degree focus so that you are completely aware of and attentive to the attack that's coming to you. But you also have to have a simultaneous 360-degree awareness. That's paying attention. So you are alert to everything that's happening everywhere simultaneously, but not in a representational way. So principle one, be present. Principle two, pay attention. Principle three, listen deeply. Listening deeply is not just listening with your ears to sound. It's being totally receptive to everything. It's listening inside yourself. It's listening to intuition. It's listening to what's happening outside. It's listening not only to what people are saying, but to what they really mean. What are the meta messages? It's listening to the temperature. It's listening to the passage of time. Listening to your relationship in space to other things. It's listening. Listening is receiving the totality of things that are going on in this moment. Those three are what I really learned over the 11 years of studying meditation in the ashram. That to me is meditation. Be present, pay attention, listen deeply. Again, there's no content in any of them. There's nothing that smacks of I can talk to you about the ultimate experience of human existence or anything precious. It's not, I've read 20,000 books and I'm now going to tell you all of it. It's not information-based. It's not information. It's not data. It has to do with being aware and connecting to life so that we can actually live life and not go through the dream of it by living in the thought stream. Then I learned two more principles. One, the fourth one, speak truthfully. Speak truthfully. Seems easy, but we don't do it. We often don't even tell ourselves the truth. So after you've listened deeply, then you need to then start bringing that out into the world. Speak truthfully. By truthfully, I mean one's own truth in this moment. Simply, it's this. What do I think? What do I feel? What do I want? What do I not want? That's one's truth. We have to speak truthfully, and we don't for any number of reasons. When we start speaking truthfully, we start energizing our life with integrity. Integrity simply means wholeness. I don't mean some sense of ethical or moral rightness, but in a sense of wholeness. And a sense of power and strength comes from that integrity, comes from that speaking truthfully, which then flows into the fifth principle, act creatively. A lot of people in personal growth, spiritual development, get caught in their heads. They get caught in the ideas of things. They think that you can visualize and affirm your way through life, that you can sit down and think your way through life. You can download intuition and get through life. Life is an energetic activity. Life is a phenomenon of action and energy. Everything is in action. Everything is growing. Everything is happening. It's a happening thing. The more action we take, the more we can see the truth of where we are and who we are. You can think anything you want, and the test of it is, let's see you take an action. If you're going to say that you are one with the cosmic consciousness, you're one with infinite existence, fantastic, what a nice idea. Let's see what that looks like. What can you do with it? Because consciousness has manifested this incredible universe of billions of galaxies. What can you do? And so it's the action that really is what determines our experience of living, because it cuts through the facade of delusion and creates a sense of realism, taking an action. If we're uncertain, if we have fear, if we have doubt, take an action. Not a random action, not a fear-based action, not a wild action, but an action that comes from being present, paying attention, listening deeply, speaking the truth, then take an action and make it be creative. Don't ask someone else how to have a relationship. Why not have a relationship that has never been seen in the world before? Why not create something so unique, so original, so beautiful, so powerful, so creative that it's extraordinary? And you can do that by being present, paying attention, listening deeply, speaking truthfully, acting creatively. And it struck me that these are the five principles that I've been using for 30 years, real-time speaking, Lisa, which I've been doing now for 4 years, is something that I created in response to a woman saying, Robert, I love how you speak. Can you teach me to speak the way you do? I said, let me think about it. And 4 years later, it's an internationally recognized brand simply because I did the five principles. When I'm doing work in organizations, wherever I'm doing anything, the difference that I make and the difference that needs to be made, because very few people can do it, are those five principles. Everyone has got so much learning, so many degrees, so many theories, so many models, so many paradigms, that they can't be present. Life is where the present is. One person came to a program I did a few days ago on the Gold Coast, and I had gone to his website, and he had 18 different credentials and certificates. And I thought, interesting, that's 18 ways for him not to be present. 18 different ways not to see what's actually going on. And all the people who have come to me over the years have MBAs and PhDs and certifications, and they know this, that, and the other thing, but they can't get present enough to connect with life where it's happening. So you go, well, let's be present. Then pay attention, listen deeply, speak truthfully, act creatively. These are the five principles that I think if people are willing to explore them and use them, they themselves in the moment can generate the greatest and truest wisdom for them, because instead of collecting the golden eggs of other people, they'll realize they're the goose that can lay a golden egg whenever they want it. Why in the world do I care what the Buddha was supposed to have said, or anyone else? I'd rather know, well, where did you say it from? If there's something interesting and exciting and compelling about what you're saying, I'd rather know, where did you say it from? Where did you get it? Not what did you get, because that's yours. What you get by using the five principles is you fulfilling what only you can fulfill, which is your own self. Authenticity, which is what people, I think, really want, to break free and become what only they can become. How free can you be? How authentic can you be? How excited about life can you be if you keep loading yourself up with what other people think and what other people say? Because, you know, life is not a problem. There's really nothing to sort out, nothing to solve, no purpose to find. There's nothing really to do. We're alive for a couple of moments. And even as you and I are talking, there's so much tremendous mystery. There's so much unfolding. There's so much enormity. I mean, our planet, you and I are speaking. You're in Colorado. I'm in Sydney. And the planet is spinning. It's rotating around the sun. We don't feel that, but it is. It's 65,000 miles an hour. And our solar system, the Earth and Venus and Mars and the sun, in turn, is moving through the Milky Way, through the galaxy, somewhere around 600,000 miles an hour. And the galaxy, the Milky Way itself, is in turn spinning through the cosmos at about 1 million miles an hour. So without any feeling of it, you and I are speeding through the cosmos at about 1.5 million miles an hour. We don't even know about that. We could look and find an equivalent amazement just by looking at the structure of the brain. Wherever we turn, if we connect directly with things, it's just stunning. It's so stunning. And the more immediately we connect with life, the less burdened we are by time. And then we just live in this extraordinary moment-to-moment amazement. Connection is almost automatic because once we're out of representational thinking, we fall into life. You don't have to have some mystical experience, mystical path to anywhere. You're already there. Forget content. Forget reading books. There's a place for information, certainly. There's a place for data,
but it doesn't help anyone do what they most want to do, which is become fully alive, fully awake, fully alert. Somewhere they want that. They may not necessarily know it, but wherever they're trying to become happier, wherever they're trying to become more fulfilled, more connected, more alive, more purposeful, they're saying, I want to be fully alive. I want to be awake. I want to connect with life, because they feel some kind of sadness, some kind of disconnect, some sense of meaninglessness. I mean, people talk a lot about meaning and purpose. Why would they talk about meaning and purpose? If they were fully connected to the only game in town, which we could call life. Life doesn't have meaning and purpose that's discernible to us. We can invent something. People make up all kinds of stories. But those kinds of stories only appeal to people who are lost and confused. And then they find the salvation in someone's narrative and someone's myth or story that is full of thought, keeps them right in the center of representational reality. And as long as you keep everything else away, build your fort around that, you'll be safe. But sooner or later, something's going to come in and disturb that, disturb the representational reality that you live in, the belief system, the ideology. Something's going to crack through that, and then you'll be lost again. The antidote to feeling lost and confused, or to feeling that you want to aspire to more aliveness, is not content. It is not a formula. It's five simple principles that will immediately engage you with life, wherein you will become fully original and authentic naturally, because that's what you naturally are. Life is apparent. It's already self-evident. The only thing is we can't see it because we're not present. We keep thinking the beautiful pictures in the cookbooks are the tasty food that we can never seem to really find. Where are you? What are you looking at? Are you looking at what is, or are we looking at pictures of what is?
And the pictures are our ideas about ourselves, our ideas about life, our belief systems about how life should be.
That's it. That's exactly what they are. And I'm not suggesting that we try to eliminate those, because we can. You know,
right.
Thinking is part of what the brain does. There's nothing wrong with them. We just have to disconnect from them and not believe in them as representing reality. We keep trying to sort out the dilemmas of living in representational ways, whether it's, you know, the thoughts and the concepts and the beliefs, or even in presenting a language-based version of it. If you ask people why they do their hobbies or their avocational things or their vocational things, whether it is skiing, surfing, rollerblading, whatever people do, underneath whatever, whatever they say it, it's because that takes them out of the thought stream and connects them through action to the immediacy of life. Even if they don't know it, because as soon as they're done with the activity, they'll start thinking about it and they won't really know that they've actually left their mind. Why do we like sex so much? It's kind of hard to be worrying about tomorrow or regretting yesterday right in the middle of your big O. There's an immediacy to it that takes us out of representational reality, and we move into the total connection, in which we don't really need self-image, we don't need beliefs, we don't have to have any of that. We can, but just to play with it.
So what you're suggesting is you don't need to give up your ideas about yourself or how life works, but don't take them so seriously. Don't live from those ideas.
Exactly. Have them, don't live from them. I love that. You can't stop the mind. I mean, don't even try. No one's ever done it. You're not supposed to do it. You got a mind because, you know, the mind does good things. You step out into the street and the mind is going to help you identify this thing called a bus. And it's good because you can get on the bus and the bus will take you somewhere. You could step out of the way of the bus so the bus doesn't run you over. You know, if you're going from here to there, the mind can help you plan a route. It's very good. But, you know, in terms of telling you about existence, not so good. You know, Rumi, the Sufi poet, who some 700-800 years after his death, is now, I think he's the best-selling poet in America. His beautiful line, however you think it is, it's different than that. He didn't say, because you can't get it right, stop thinking. He just said, hey, however you think it is, it's different than that. That's all you got to know. So if you know that your thinking is going to miss the mark, but your mechanism still thinks, then fine. Go ahead and think. I do. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't get in the way. I don't believe it. I use it. I don't believe it. I believe in being present. I believe in paying attention. I believe in listening deeply. I believe in speaking truthfully. And I believe in acting creatively. You can see it. You can see the beauty of someone who is just present. You can see it sometimes in martial artists, in dance. You can see it in different places, different moments, different times. And I think we all can flash into that. It's not something that's foreign. This is like we're built for this. We are never not there. That's never not instantly available. And when you see it, you can look in their eyes, and it's like that kind of hazy cataract film of excessive thinking is gone, and they're just present, and they're awake, 1 degree focus, 360-degree awareness, and they're listening, they're alert. And then when they speak, it's simple, and it's direct, and then they act, and it's beautiful. They just act. Fantastic.
The word that comes to mind is the Carlos Castaneda word, impeccable.
Exactly. I love that. I love that. Impeccability. Of course, the risk is that we will now take a picture of impeccability, put it in the book, and just keep licking the picture of impeccability. Lisa, you've been involved in this for 20 years. You've organized many, many programs. You know lots of teachers. You see people go from one to another. Why is there no final resting place for people? Why isn't it that people have found what they've been looking for years after year after year, teacher after teacher, path after path, system after system, broken promise after broken promise, and all they want to do is have one moment of being fully alive?
Well, they're looking for it in the wrong place. They're trying to get aliveness from the known and the conceptual, and it's not there.
They're trying to become alive by licking the picture. See how you do? You've got books there. Just instead of eating, I know you love pasta and wine, stop that. Just start licking paper and see how you go. I mean, if you're a goat, okay. Last time I saw you, you didn't look like a goat. People do hear. They do hear their authentic self. They do hear their natural self. But then they've got to speak about it and take an action. That's where we fail. So what happens is just as we begin to verge on leaving the paper world, we verge on leaving the conceptual world, we hear something that wants to be said and done from way deep down where we're alive and real, we don't. Then we start creating the story. But as soon as we start believing in the story, we can't be present anymore. Being present means non-representational. So you can't start telling a story, a cover story, to excuse the fact that you didn't speak the truth and you didn't take an action. The other day at a talk, someone said, I've been in this job for 2 years. It's mind-numbing. I hate it. I hate my job. What do you recommend? I said, look for another job. She goes, well, I thought of that. I said, well, no. What have you done about it? She goes, nothing. I said, well, you've got to act. Action connects you to life force. Life is energy. Life force, Shakti. It's alive. Things happen. You can't if you're out of the action flow, if you're not an action hero, you can't possibly be alive. Where are the gaps in the storytelling to let pure presence appear? Where are people being present, paying attention, listening deeply, speaking truthfully, acting creatively? Where do you see that? If you see that in a person, I guarantee you that is a person who is going to be fully, fully, deeply peaceful and content and satisfied moment to moment without any sense of purpose or meaning or anything else. They're just going to be like some occurrence in nature. And I think there's a way that we can live like that. We can live with the suddenness and the totality. You can call it impeccable if you want, just because it's so full, complete in itself. It's not, you know, a monsoon is not representational. It's not a picture of a monsoon, you know, as we know from the tsunami. Everything else in nature but us is action-oriented. So I suppose, and I've never said this before, perhaps my main advice to people is just stop licking pictures. You know, if you're going to lick something, I mean, lick something, you know, real and worthwhile. I'm not against licking, but you know, there's no point in licking pictures. And I think that's what I've seen every place along the way is the content that people crave is the very thing that's in the way. The more content, the more systems, formulas, laws of attraction, laws of unattraction, laws of this. There's no laws. The law of attraction. Give me a break. Made up.
But it's comforting to people.
It will not be comforting if it comes at the expense of connecting directly with life. Sooner or later, it will not be a comfort because you're going to know there's a difference between licking the paper and eating the meal. You can have all the material success in the world. It still doesn't mean that you're going to be fully alive, fully awake, fully connected. I'm talking about whether you're alive or whether you're in your head. Is it real or is it not real? Are you in the picture or are you in the reality? That's really the fundamental difference. And I can tell you that when you pop into real life, your values, your goals, your aspirations, everything changes because you're no longer lost and confused. You self-generate spontaneously your own wisdom and your own knowing. You got to really learn to identify, recognize those moments in which we're touching the hot stove, the immediacy of living, and recognize the difference between that and living in the picture book. And realizing that how we get out of the picture book is stop believing in the content. And just start being present, start paying attention, start listening deeply, start speaking truthfully, start acting creatively, and then see what problems you have in life. See what's left. There won't be anything left. I think if people play with those in their own way, make them yours, and just be mindful of the tendency to fall back into the conceptualization of what I've just said, keep returning to the immediacy of living, that's it.
What you're suggesting with these principles, that if people work with these principles, they're going to move with life. And the analogy that comes to my mind is surfing. You know, versus the satsang being sitting on the beach or, you know, just surfing from the shore versus being on that surfboard and riding the wave.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's scary. It's uncertain. It's not necessarily safe, but that's, if you want aliveness, you got to go out on that surfboard and ride the wave. You don't get the aliveness from watching from the beach.
Well, absolutely. I love that. if you ask some of the big wave surfers, like Laird Hamilton and some of those folks, and they're out there riding 70, 80, 90-foot waves, if you talk to them, they'll tell you. One of the reasons they do it is because that's their sacred church. They go, the big waves, that's when we go to church. That's when we go to have our sacred moment with life. You're going to fall. You're going to wipe out. You might die. I love that because to me, it's the safety factor that keeps us licking the pages of the book. Now, I'm not saying we all have to surf, but somewhere you got to be alive. You got to be courting and risking the danger of immediacy of living. You're exactly right. And part of leaving the safety of the storytelling is, it's saying, I don't know. One of the things we risk when we start paddling out to life is the certainty of the made up nonsense that we otherwise use to feel safe. In a universe in which we're speeding through a cosmos at 1.6 million miles an hour, and with how many hundreds of physiological processes go on in our own body every minute, about which we're aware of none, because we just live in this made-up world. We live in this mind world. And if we can start directly experiencing things, we're going to not know anything. And that's where we're least willing to risk the safety of the made-up stuff.
Thank you for listening to this telephone interview with Robert Rabin. Robert's real-time speaking audiobook is available at wetwaremedia.com. That's WARE MEDIA.com.